It is Tuesday, July 14th. Things are moving fast, and the headlines are starting to feel like they are coming from a different decade entirely. Let's get into what actually matters before the day gets away from us. In February, the U.S. Court of International Trade ruled that the Trump administration's unilateral tariffs were illegal. The court found that the president lacked the constitutional authority to levy those specific taxes, noting that the power belongs to Congress. Wall Street firms have since begun buying up refund claims from importers at a discount, betting that the government will eventually be forced to pay out. This isn't just about a balance sheet error. It is a massive failure of governance. The administration used emergency declarations to bypass oversight, but those declarations didn't hold up under legal scrutiny. The tariffs ended up acting as a tax on American consumers instead of a penalty on foreign nations. We are essentially watching public money get siphoned off into private balance sheets because the executive branch decided to play pretend with the Constitution. Speaking of institutional failure, ICE, pronounced ICE, is currently operating under a decentralized model. One estimate suggests this has increased contact between agents and the public by 600%. Arrests have jumped from 300 to over 2,000 per day. There have been at least 9 deaths during immigration enforcement actions since the start of the current administration, with 4 of those occurring this year. Former Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Gil Kerlikowsk, pronounced K-E-R-Likowski, notes that agents are often using aggressive tactical maneuvers like boxing in vehicles. These are high-risk tactics that don't belong in municipal policing. When you combine that with a lack of body cameras and a culture that prioritizes defensive reporting over transparency, you get a system that views accountability as an obstacle. It is a hell of a thing to watch an agency with over $100 billion in funding insist that it cannot afford basic transparency tools. The common thread here is that we've replaced professional infrastructure with a reliance on shortcuts. Whether it's a business scaling too fast without accounting, or a government agency ignoring its own training manuals to hit a quota, the result is the same. The mess compounds until the system breaks. Look at microfinance. It was sold as a way to help the poor pull themselves up. Now, it has largely morphed into a predatory debt trap where the goal is volume, not the borrower's success. International institutions and banks have looked the other way, prioritizing their own returns over ethical standards. When a Cambodian watchdog report on lending practices was recently rejected, it made the priorities clear. They aren't trying to fix poverty. They are trying to extract capital from the people who have the least to give. Even our legislative branch is struggling with the basics of operational continuity. Congress has no mandatory health disclosure rules. When members get sick, the public is often left guessing based on photos or anecdotes. It turns a private medical issue into a political crisis. Because the legislature requires physical presence to vote, a single absence can paralyze the whole process. That is a rigid, outdated way to run a country. It turns seniority into a trap where members hide their declining capacity just to keep their influence. None of this is accidental. When you strip away the official narratives, you see a recurring pattern. Systems are being built for maximum throughput, whether that is arrests, loans, or executive orders, without any regard for the structural integrity of the institution itself. The people in charge are betting that they can manage the consequences through spin or temporary policy pauses. It's a gamble that relies on the public not noticing the rot in the floorboards. But eventually, the growth or the volume you're chasing catches up to you. You can't scale a failure, and you certainly can't audit your way out of a collapse once the documentation stops matching reality. It turns out that the boring, administrative, and ethical work of running an institution is the only thing actually keeping it together. Everything else is just theater. That kind of institutional rot is expensive, but it's not the only place where reality is catching up to the books. The market is finally waking up to the same cold truth. The stock market is rotating. Investors are moving away from narrow AI-focused semiconductor bets and toward broader sectors like biotech and consumer goods. This isn't a structural collapse, it is a functional reset. Earnings growth in the chip sector simply stopped keeping pace with the massive expectations investors had priced in. Here is the thing about this shift. The market is finally acknowledging that the hyperscalers, the companies spending the most on AI infrastructure, are under pressure to justify those costs. When they pull back, it forces capital into neglected areas of the economy. If you are still chasing the momentum trade, you are fighting a losing battle against a Fed that is prioritizing inflation over growth. The smart money is currently looking for fundamentally sound companies that have been left behind. Meanwhile, the conversation around AI governance is changing. It is moving away from the extinction-level event, alarmism of last year, and toward boring, practical economic policy. The new Stanford Digital Economy Lab petition, for instance, focuses on job displacement and economic transformation rather than sci-fi nightmares. This is a welcome change. It suggests the field is finally maturing enough to talk about actual guardrails instead of just chasing headlines. But do not mistake this for a consensus. There is a real tension building here. On one side, you have people like Demis Hassabis, pronounced D.E.H. Miss Hassabis, proposing an oversight body similar to the finance industry's FINRA. They want stewardship. On the other side, critics argue that aggressive regulation will just hand the lead in AI to our geopolitical rivals. It is a shitty situation. Governments might end up building permanent surveillance infrastructure under the guise of solving risks that, quite frankly, might never actually happen. Look at Australia. They are currently trying to build a national AI framework to attract companies like Microsoft and Anthropic. They want to simplify data center approvals, but they are stuck in a legislative deadlock over copyright. Tech firms want to train models on copyrighted works without paying for it, or, at least, they want a clear fair use path. Artists have already rejected a proposed $350 million fund to settle the issue. If Australia opens the door, they lose their creative IP rights. If they keep the door closed, they lose the data centers. It is a classic trap. This same pressure is showing up in enterprise spending. IBM recently missed revenue targets, and their stock saw a significant decline. The reason is simple. Corporate clients are prioritizing hardware, memory, and storage over software and consulting. They are terrified of supply chain instability through 27. They want the physical capacity to run these models before prices rise. IBM is getting squeezed out because their services are being treated as optional, while the iron and silicon are being treated as essential. We are also seeing a weird, potentially coercive shift in how AI is used at work. Models are moving toward architectural management, where users define goals for autonomous agents. It sounds efficient, but it creates a psychological trap. Users are falling into a cycle of token maxing, where they feel pressured to keep these models running to satisfy internal productivity metrics. It is basically the digital version of mouse-shaking software for remote workers. The irony is that this is happening in an economy already defined by extreme wealth concentration. We are building a layer of autonomous AI that is likely to benefit a very small elite, while the systemic instability, the job displacement, and the burnout falls on everyone else. If your organization is treating AI engagement as a proxy for performance, you are going to burn out your team for the sake of metrics that don't actually deliver real economic value. The market is currently reconciling a cooling inflation rate of 3.5% with the reality of rising enterprise costs. It is a high-velocity environment. The companies that survive the next leg of this aren't the ones with the best hype cycles. They are the ones that can manage their infrastructure, keep their expenses under control, and actually produce something of value that doesn't require a constant, dopamine-fueled feedback loop to justify its existence. Anyway, that is where we stand. investors are getting bored of the hype, which is a welcome change of pace. It turns out that building something that actually works is a better long-term play than just betting on stars. In a recent match, Spain defeated France 2-0. The match was defined by a stark contrast in philosophy. Spain leaned on a fluid, system-oriented tactical framework. France relied on a star-centric model that pivoted on the speed of Kylian Mbappé, pronounced Mbappé. When Spain scored early, France failed to adapt. Their reliance on a defensive counterattacking setup left them without a functional backup plan. France generated less than 0.3 expected goals while chasing the game. It is a hell of a thing to watch a team with that much individual talent just freeze up. France had the better players on paper, but they played like they were reading from a script that had been shredded 10 minutes into the match. When you build a house of cards that only stays standing if the score stays 0-0, you are asking for a collapse. That is exactly what happened. Spain played the whole pitch, even getting goals from fullbacks making striker runs. France just swapped like-for-like players and hoped for a miracle that never showed up. It wasn't just a loss. It was a tactical bankruptcy. Manchester United is currently applying a similar logic to their roster construction. The club is moving away from chasing high-cost, high-risk stars. They are instead prioritizing value-driven signings like Yori Tielemans, pronounced T.E. Lemons, and Andre Santos. The goal here is simple. They want to raise the performance floor of the team to survive a long season. They are sacrificing short-term flash to ensure that when a key starter goes down, the entire ship doesn't go under. It is a boring strategy, I know. Nobody buys a jersey because the team signed a reliable depth piece who understands his role. But that is the trade-off. You can either build a team that looks like a collection of mercenaries who might win it all or might implode in October, or you can build a system. United seems to have finally realized that individual brilliance is a luxury, not a foundation. Most teams are just one bad injury away from irrelevance, if they don't have a structure that can actually survive the attrition. This tension between raw talent and structural fit is playing out in the NBA Summer League, too. Teams are currently evaluating prospects like AJ Dabonza, pronounced Dabio Enza, and Caleb Wilson. These leagues are essentially high-pressure laboratories for physical tools. Teams often force young, ball-dominant players into high-usage roles to test their limits. They call these atrophy reps. The goal is to see what the kid can do with the ball in his hands before they inevitably ask him to stop being the star and start being a productive, complementary piece. Except that transition is the hardest part of the job. You have these kids coming out of college where they were the main character for 4 years. Then they get to the league and the coach tells them they need to be the next Al Horford or Derek White. Those guys aren't the ones scoring 30 points a night. They are the ones plugging gaps, playing lockdown defense, and making the system work. People who only look at box scores think these guys are just role players. In reality, they are the only reason their teams actually win games in the postseason. The problem is that half the league is still obsessed with the shiny object. If a prospect looks good in summer league because he's taking 20 shots a game, teams get blinded by the stats. They ignore the fact that he has no concept of off-ball movement or defensive discipline. If you draft for the highlight reel, you get a stagnant roster where nobody knows how to play with anyone else. You get a team that looks great on opening night and completely falls apart by the playoffs. It's the same trap France fell into. You can have all the talent in the world. If you don't have a system that makes the parts fit, you are just waiting to be outplayed by someone who actually knows how to build a team. Talent is great, but as we are seeing, a team that doesn't know how to function together is just a collection of expensive parts. That same need for a foundation applies to everything, including your own biology. Cognitive decline is increasingly understood not as an inevitable consequence of aging, but as a result of cumulative metabolic damage. Research shows that microglial, pronounced microglial cells, which are the immune sentinels of the brain, shift into a destructive inflammatory state when the body is under metabolic stress. This process is driven by insulin resistance and ultra-processed foods, creating a cycle of neuroinflammation that can begin decades before symptoms appear. The takeaway here is that middle-aged individuals possess significant agency to preserve brain function. By monitoring biomarkers like fasting insulin and homocysteine, pronounced HOH-MoSISTine, and prioritizing metabolic health, one can steer these immune cells toward a protective state. It is a hell of a thing to realize that your brain health today is being negotiated by the lunch you ate 20 years ago. We treat cognitive decline like a surprise guest who just shows up to ruin the party. In reality, we are essentially building the house that neurodegeneration moves into long before we ever see the blueprints. If you are in your 30s or 40s, you are currently in the most high-leverage period of your life for this. It's not about finding a magic pill later. It's about not setting the fire in the first place. Financial planning for retirement is undergoing a similar shift toward proactive resilience. The focus is moving away from chasing total portfolio returns and toward creating a bond ladder that covers the first 5 to 10 years of retirement. This strategy helps mitigate sequence of returns risk, which is the danger of a market downturn forcing you to sell assets at depressed prices early in your retirement. Experts suggest treating retirement as a dynamic, evolving project rather than a static math problem. This means recasting spending projections annually and proactively planning for the transition in identity from a professional role to a personal one. There is a weird, quiet anxiety in the way we talk about money. Most people treat retirement planning like a sprint toward a finish line where you just cross over and stop. But the math doesn't care about your feelings, and it certainly doesn't care about your identity crisis. The biggest risk isn't just running out of cash. It's the refusal to spend it because you're scared of a future you haven't actually modeled. If you don't define what your no-go years look like, you're just dumping a logistical nightmare onto your kids. That is a shitty situation to leave for the people you supposedly saved all that money for. Cancer prevention and treatment are also moving toward precision-based models that prioritize risk-based screening over broad, reactive testing. Current medical innovation faces a bottleneck because early detection tools like liquid biopsies can produce more false positives than true detections in the general population. Experts emphasize that these tools are most effective for individuals with a higher prior probability of disease, such as those with specific genetic mutations or family histories. Meanwhile, domestic medical innovation is facing a strategic challenge due to broken supply chains and an increasing reliance on foreign-sourced pharmaceuticals. The data on cancer screening highlights a fundamental truth about modern medicine. We love the idea of a whole-body scan to solve all our problems, but we ignore the Bayesian, pronounced B-A-Y-Z-U-N, reality that testing rare events in healthy people leads to a mountain of false alarms. It's the medical equivalent of checking your smoke alarm every 5 seconds. It won't stop the fire, but it will definitely drive you crazy. We are obsessed with the search for a single magic bullet. But the real progress is happening in the boring, incremental work of fixing supply chains and understanding tumor environments. These three areas, metabolic health, retirement logistics, and cancer screening, share a common denominator. They all demand that you stop acting like a passive passenger in your own life. Whether it is your brain, your bank account, or your biology, the systems are vulnerable to volatility. If you wait for the system to break before you try to fix it, you have already lost the leverage that makes prevention possible. It's not about predicting the future perfectly. It's about building a foundation that doesn't collapse the moment the wind changes direction. That requires data, foresight, and a willingness to acknowledge that you are the one responsible for the outcome. Taking care of your own house is the only real hedge you have against a chaotic world. On that note, here are a few other things you should keep on your radar today. Reading for pleasure is down, dropping from 28% in 2004 to 16% last year. It turns out that if you stop exercising your brain with long-form prose, you actually lose the ability to think in concepts, which honestly explains a hell of a lot about our current discourse. Voters are increasingly ditching the idea that congressional experience is a resume builder. They see Washington as a graveyard for actual results and are now looking to governors who have at least managed to pass a state budget without burning the building down. In e-commerce, the real money isn't in selling to everyone. It is in finding preference minorities, those people whose local shops never carry what they actually need. If you cater to the people the big box stores ignore, you end up with a customer base that is fiercely loyal. If you are a startup in a restricted industry like firearms, you cannot rely on social media ads. You have to build via word of mouth and live events, which is actually a blessing in disguise because your business won't collapse the moment an algorithm changes. Big legal departments love using SLAPP suits to bleed critics dry with massive fees, regardless of whether their case has any merit. The only way to win that game is to make the whole thing so public that the legal bullying becomes a PR nightmare for them. Finally, the situation in the Persian Gulf is a masterclass in bad faith. Iran isn't using ceasefires to pursue peace. They are using them as tactical pauses to restock their supply of missiles and drones. It is a shitty way to conduct diplomacy, but it is exactly what they have been doing for years. That is the wrap for tonight. Get some sleep, do something that doesn't involve a screen, and I will see you tomorrow.